Well, glad to have you here for this part of Focus 580. In this part of the show, we'll talk, at least in part, about the idea of upward mobility and how it is we think about that, both here in the United States and also in Britain. Because here, certainly in this country, we have believed for a long, long time that upward mobility is basically just a matter of remaking yourself. You pick up some new skills, you enhance your package a little bit, and higher standard of living will follow. Well, that may or may not be true, but certainly we have that idea. That idea also exists in Britain, although perhaps it's a bit more recent. The question we'll take up is, does that really work? And how is it that people think that way? And perhaps whether this idea of the makeover is really important to the way we think about the economy today and people's place in it. And our guest for this hour of Focus 580 is Valerie Walkerdine. She's professor of psychology in the School of Social Sciences at Cardiff University in the UK. She is visiting the campus. She gave a talk last night. We'll give another tomorrow about some of her various interests. And is here with us this morning to talk. We will take on this topic. Perhaps also we'll talk a little bit about some of her other research, which deals with a rather different topic, and that has to do with video games as they pertain to gender issues, because among her interests certainly are the experiences of girls as they grow up in our society. She'll be giving this talk, by the way, this one about video games, tomorrow, 1 o'clock in the afternoon, on the third floor of the Levis Center on the U of I campus. It's open to the public. That's sponsored by the College of Communications, the Institute of Communications Research, and the Department of Speech Communications. And they are inviting anybody who is interested. Also, of course, here on the program as we talk, people are welcome to call in with questions. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, thank you very much.
Well, it's very good to be here.
If it doesn't seem too frivolous, the place that I want to start is to talk a little bit about the tremendous popularity of the idea of the makeover.
Yeah.
Here now in this country, in the United States, we have a number of television programs that are all about that. And I know, I'm sure that people listening will be familiar.
Yes.
People who make over their houses, make over other people's houses, and make over themselves.
Yep.
Tremendous, I think it taps into, you know, the idea of the fairy godmother. I think is one that we all have buried deep in our psyches. The idea that someone is going to come along and magically make us and our lives better and
absolutely
wonderful. And it's no less, I'm sure, an idea in Britain, because after all, that's where we stole the idea for these programs. Because indeed, programs like What Not to Wear and Trading Spaces or Places or whatever were stolen from the BBC.
Yes.
There were
yes.
British programs before. So obviously, people in Britain
have
the same sort of thing. So maybe let's start there, and then we can start making some connections between economics.
Yes.
Why do you think that these sorts of things have for so many people, I guess, have such a great appeal?
Well, I mean, I think they had appeal for me when I was a teenager. You know, the idea that I could somehow be better, smarter, prettier, you know, would find the man of my dreams if only I looked the right shape, I wore the right clothes, I would be fashionable if I could, you know, do my rather tatty-looking bedroom out in, you know, in the latest style. You know, all those kinds of things are not new, are they? But I think the appeal of the makeover is precisely that we can, as you said, make ourselves into something that is the product of our own fantasy, the product of our own wishes, and that actually if we do make ourselves over in this way, our lives will be better and happier. But I think it has a particular place within the present context, because people are so encouraged to keep on, as you said, in upward mobility, to kind of keep remaking themselves in order to get the right job, meet the right man, get the right income. And the sense that it's that will give us happiness, that our lives will be complete if we do those things. And I think that's really quite different from the ways in which perhaps at other times communities lived. You know, they got happiness out of aspects of their relations in the community, not by being the desired kind of person. Whereas nowadays, as you say, on British television, just as here, we're absolutely bombarded with this idea that we can make ourselves and remake ourselves again and again.
Mm-hmm. And is it, I guess it's my perception that a lot of that has to do with, certainly there are, as part of these people, in a very literal way, remake themselves. Mm-hmm. But it is more about stuff. It is more about the stuff that we have, the stuff that are indicators of our stylishness,
yeah,
of our status. You know, it does. There is a very strong connection between consumption of material goods.
Yeah.
And maybe not surprising, because we've always used that as a way to show, well, are you doing well? What kind of car do you have? And what does your house look
sure.
like? There's this very strong connection between the idea of upward mobility and packaging ourselves and stuff.
Well, I suppose you say it's always been like that. But actually, you know, the British would really like to think until some time ago that it was a kind of American phenomenon, and that we did class in Britain rather differently. You know, that actually it wasn't about showing what you had. It was about the kind of breeding you had, the kind of person you were. And actually, showiness was kind of thought of as rather nouveau riche. I mean, you didn't do it. But I think that has changed a lot in Britain, and I would say it's changed over the last 20 years or so, when consumer goods have become more readily available, but also the need to enter different kinds of work where you have to package yourself. You know, where people have, particularly men, I think, have gone from factory work, manufacturing work, to service industries. Women always had to be presentable in offices, but far more men go into that kind of work now. So you've got to sell yourself and be presentable and live the dream. I think that idea of living this particular dream is relatively new in Britain, and some people would see it as rather American. Some people like that. Some people would be more derogatory about it, I guess, in Britain. Yeah. Of course, you know, I said the last 20 years, but you could also trace this right back to the 1950s when, you know, people started to, well, in Britain at least, to get fridges, washing machines. And of course, people in Britain were always looking to America, where they thought, you know, everybody always had bigger fridges and better cars and that kind of thing. So, you know, I think the relationship between how to present yourself and you know, living this aspiration and dream is interestingly different across the two countries, but it's becoming closer together.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's interesting. I do think about the notion that I have of upper class Britons and how one live, and you do have this idea that the people at the very top lived in these big crumbling piles of stone,
yeah,
with on the wall hanging pictures of their great 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 grandfather and wearing their grandfather's tweeds, and somehow that was the way that you were supposed to live. Is that, has that changed, or is that still the same?
Well, I think that's probably still the same, but what you've got is more a more obvious cult of celebrity, so that you know, there's much more display of wealth than there used to be. I mean, yes, sure, you know, an aristocrat would live in a kind of castle or something, and that would be its own display of wealth. But I mean a different kind, the much more flashy presentation of wealth. I mean, perhaps, you know, one couple would be you know, the soccer player David Beckham, who seems to be well known here, mm-hmm, and, you know, Posh Spice. So, you know, Posh and Becks are on the front page of newspapers all the time, and their style is copied, they're well known. So you get a much more of a sense of the presentation of the spectacle, of the flamboyant lifestyle. And I think there's an interesting relationship between the cult of celebrity and therefore presentation of the celebrity lifestyle and a kind of reality television in which you can make yourself over to be just a bit more like them. So, I mean, when we're talking about the aristocrat in his castle, you know, you could never aspire to being like that. That was a question of breeding. You were born into it. Now there's the sense that, you know, you could possibly become this. Mm-hmm. I mean, after all, David Beckham's just a, you know, a working class boy who's good at football.
And see where it's taken him. Yeah. Well, I'm interested in trying to make the connection now between this and the economy. Because we are now entering into a time when things have changed and are changing. The kind of work people do, the change in the expectation that one would do the same kind of work all one's life. Mm-hmm. We are taught that insecurity is just part of the landscape now. That one should be prepared to do different things and perhaps by extension to be different people, and that. I guess I wonder whether, in fact, that kind of economic reality demands people who will accept this notion of the makeover, of making themselves over, being different people, doing different jobs, and I suppose they would hope in the process then becoming better off, at least as measured by, you know, the way that you live your life, the kind of in a material sense.
Well, I mean, I happen to think that that's right, that actually one of the shifts that we can see, obviously, all over the world, but, you know, my particular knowledge is of Britain, is that shift away from people working, you know, all their lives in the same job, and at the end, you know, at 65, they get the gold watch and they retire. And that's gone. That's disappeared for very, very many people. I mean, as an academic, I'm probably one of the few people that will actually, you know, get to stay in the same kind of job for my working life. But most people don't get to do that anymore. So they've got to get used to exactly what you're saying, that sense of a makeover. They've got to become perhaps one kind of person to do one job. And then they've got to have the flexible skills and different kind of presentation to do something that may be entirely different. And the idea is that they've got to learn these new skills and keep presenting themselves and inventing themselves in a different kind of way throughout their working life. And that, of course, puts a lot of demands on your presentation of yourself. And that is exactly what I connect with the idea of the makeover.
Yeah. And this is something that I think you're particularly interested in, looking at the experience of women.
I am.
In this. Do you think that it's the case that somehow women have been more successful at this than men?
Well, I don't know about more successful, but I think it's a newer thing for men. That would be my guess, because, you see, I think that women have been incited, you know, suggested that they make themselves over to be attractive. You know, the idea that women have to be presentable, have to be attractive for men, basically, is an old idea. And that, you know, we have to see ourselves in the gaze of somebody else who can really tell us who we are and whether we're good enough and what we look like. And so, of course, women for a very, very long time have developed a great deal of skill at being able to do that and to be rather more kind of chameleon-like. You know, you've got to, you know, women are used to having to be a housewife, a mother, a worker, and all those different things together and be able to swap between them. My hunch is that it's actually much more difficult for men to have to make themselves over, because that's not traditionally what men have had to do. If they've been in the same kind of job all their lives and they're apparently the ones who can choose women, etc., etc., they haven't had to make themselves presentable. But now, if many men are no longer working in manual work, for example, they're working in service work, then, of course, it demands, that kind of work demands that they present themselves. And I think we can see that in the way that makeover programs have started to be, not just be about women, but also be for men.
Yeah. We have a caller here to bring into the conversation. Perhaps I should introduce again our guest for this hour. Valerie Walkerdine is professor of psychology in the School of Social Sciences at Cardiff University. It's in Wales, is it?
It is in Wales. It's the capital of Wales, in fact.
I suspected as much. I just wanted to check my geography. She's here visiting the campus and gave a talk yesterday, and we'll give one tomorrow. And again, I'll give you that information a little bit later. The questions, comments certainly are welcome. You want to get in on the conversation, introduce some thoughts of your own, that's fine. 333-9455, toll 3-800-222-9455. Urbana is the caller, and location of the caller, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I wanted to bring up a couple things that should elicit some comments, I would think. One has to do with a article from the Brookings Institution, and one of the co-authors was a fellow from Warwick University. I don't know if that's anywhere near you.
It's in Britain. It's Warwick, actually, it's pronounced. We British pronounce things in funny ways.
If it is not in Wales, huh?
No, it's not in Wales, but it's not too far.
Okay. Well, Andrew Oswald. And he's an economist, and I want to read a few sentences from this Brookings Institution article of August 2003. He learned that Americans he's referring to a Martian that just came to the United States and he was trying to figure out what's going on economically.
Uh-huh.
And he says, he learned that Americans tolerate high levels of inequality because of strong faith in their prospects for upward mobility.
Right.
And this belief persists even though the evidence suggests that mobility rates in the U.S. are no higher and possibly even lower mm-hmm. than they are in other OECD countries.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, access to good schools, which is strongly linked to upward mobility, is increasingly stratified in the United States. Unquote. So I wanted to bring in that angle, especially since recently there's been a lot of talk about how women in particular are being denied access to good universities because of what amounts to affirmative action for men, for example. And I'm just wondering, don't you think that perhaps one of the reasons there's all this putting forward of makeover kind of shows and all that might be so that we keep this idea of upward mobility as a viable option, even though it's disintegrating all around us now?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I completely and utterly agree with you. I think that's absolutely right. I think I think that the idea of the makeover presents us with a fantasy of upward mobility. And as you say, I didn't know those particular statistics about the United States, but that would equally be true in Britain, that upward mobility, you know, there isn't a huge amount of upward mobility. It's no different than it ever was. So, yes, what we're talking about is precisely what you're saying, that it's that in a sense it's covering over the inequalities that are there by providing the fantasy of the possibility that actually that mobility is possible if you make yourself over. So you're constantly presented with this idea that you could do it. And I think the corollary of what you're saying is also that, what happens then if you don't do it, if you can't do it, if the makeover doesn't work, and you find that you don't get the lifestyle you want, or, you know, can't afford the house of your dreams, or indeed, don't get the job that you are after and you're made redundant again. Well, you know, what happens to that? I'm equally interested in that idea that this fantasy covers over an inequality which we then end up blaming ourselves for, because we have no one else to blame if we've taken on board that idea that actually only we can do it.
Hmm. Well, I think that's interesting because that does get to what is a rather cherished notion, I think, here in this country that we've had for a long time, is that it's the bootstraps idea,
yes.
Says, you know, you look at people, and if they're successful, we like to believe that hard work will get you to where you want to go.
Yeah.
And that if people aren't successful, then the temptation is to say, well, rather than look at some sort of systemic kind of explanation to say, well, obviously it's just a failure of ambition or will or ability or something like that. We like to put it onto the individual. And I suppose
yes.
also the way we think about things like psychology and personal development and all of that, we have been led in that direction to think that if you just try hard enough,
yeah.
you can be successful. And if you're not successful, obviously it must mean you're not trying hard.
Yes.
Enough.
No, I think what you're saying is very interesting, because it does talk also about the way traditionally that the differences between countries like Britain and the United States are commonly viewed, where, you know, it's generally understood that Britain does class better than the United States, and that, you know, therefore inequality is more noticeable, that it's harder to get from one class to the other. But in fact, I think it may well be the case that, as your caller suggested, there's just as much inequality here. So what's different about it is the ways that we think about these issues rather than the social inequality itself. And I am particularly concerned about the psychological issues, how, you know, psychology is brought in so that we have to think of ourselves as the person responsible for this. And therefore, you know, when something does fail, we've got to bring in somebody to support us, because only we are to blame.
Yeah. Let's talk with someone else. Here's a caller in Chicago, line number 4. Hello.
Hi, I just wanted to mention two sides, which perhaps the guest has already considered. On the one side, you know, when you say Cinderella, you say it all, because that was the classic makeover story.
That's right.
And I'm just wondering if, you know, Cinderella was in a helpless position. I'm just wondering if we, as we expand this, is this a sign that many of us are feeling absolutely helpless, not just women, but men as well, in whatever situation, and we're relying now on magic to make our lives better. And on the other hand, and this is probably cynical, and I guess I am a lot of the time, this is just big business. Two-thirds of our economy is spending. Two-thirds of our economic activity is spending. And so the makeover is the ultimate way to get people to continue to consume.
Oh, absolutely.
And to feel virtuous in consuming. And one thing I wanted to comment, I don't know if you've seen it in Britain, but here many of the stars from the makeover TV shows are now spokespeople for products, and they're doing commercials.
Oh, I didn't know that.
No,
I haven't seen that in Britain. But I think you're absolutely right about big business. Absolutely. And I think when we have economies which also depend on high levels of consumption to keep those economies going, then of course, big business is very interested in how much we consume. Absolutely. I think you're quite right about that. But you also said this thing about, you know, magic and whether, you know, we believe in magic. Well, I think the word I'd use is fantasy. Mm-hmm. I think that's a version of what you're saying about magic, that fantasy is actually an important part of our lives. Not that I'm not trying to say fantasizing is wrong or anything like that. But, you know, that I take the view that our idea of ourselves, our identities, are as much fantasy as they are anything else. So, you know, when we aspire to make ourselves over, we have an idea of, a fantasy about the person we would like to be, or what we would like to look like, and how that will make us belong or be noticed or recognised. And I think those are very important issues, which, of course, advertisers recognise very, very well, because they're always playing to our fantasies.
If I could have just one more question. What I wanted to say about the magic and the fantasy is that in the Cinderella story, it came because the person was a position of helplessness. And that's what
yes.
I'm wondering.
Yes.
Are we feeling helpless to do change? Because this is, as you, I think David said it before, the pull up by your bootstraps.
Yes.
Are we no longer feeling that we can pull ourselves up by our bootstraps? And so it has to be. And the reason why I use magical is because of this transformation, something that we don't
yeah.
quite understand,
yeah. Yeah.
but this combination of things that make the change for us. And
no,
I'll hang up and just listen.
No, I think that's a really interesting point, because, as you say, In the Cinderella story, Cinderella's helpless. But the other side of that, of course, is that, you know, it's Prince Charming who comes along. So, of course, that fantasy is also a fantasy about a woman being rescued by a man, isn't it? And, you know, what you're also talking about is a situation in which the labour market demands that women, far more women, work. So there is no Prince Charming for, you know, to actually keep women looked after at home with the male breadwinner. In fact, quite the reverse. The reverse is often the case that in many cases men are finding it harder to find work and women may find it easier to find work in service industries. So I think you're onto something really interesting about how that shift is also a magic by which we've got to somehow fantasize that we can do it ourselves without the Prince Charming there for us.
Yeah. We have another caller, a couple of other callers, someone in a neighboring community here. Belgium is the place, and line number one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. First, ma'am, do you speak Welsh?
I don't speak. I'm afraid I'm not Welsh.
Okay.
I'm afraid I'm English.
I was going to ask how you pronounce the original name of Welsh. Was Cymru? Or some of those...
Cymru, yeah, that's right.
Unpronounceable names of the cities there.
Well, unpronounceable unless you're Welsh.
Well, yeah. I guess that's true. I guess that's true. The question, or the point I wanted to point out is, it seems, though, we buy into this image that advertisement, publications, TV show for us. In other words, we have to live in this nice house. We have to fulfill this... dream that is put in front of us by advertisers and just ourselves in some strange sort of ways, instead of being just ourselves and striving on to do what we care to do ourselves and not really be so dependent upon the aspects of others.
But, you know, I mean, what about this idea? Do you think then that there is something called ourselves? I mean, you're suggesting that all of that stuff is out there, and
we could
find some part of ourselves that wasn't affected by it. I wonder if that's right.
Oh yes, ma'am. I firmly believe if you're willing to pursue your own destiny, yes, you can come across your own identity. You don't have to buy into what everybody else prescribes for you.
Well, I think that's right. You absolutely don't have to buy into what everybody prescribes for you. But at the same time, we do, in a sense, get our senses of ourselves from somewhere. We're not Robinson Crusoes on a desert island. So if we don't get them from consumption, we also get them from somewhere else. So
well, that's, the point
yeah.
I'm making.
Man. Okay, go on,
Well, the point I'm making is it's so so prevalent every place that you think you have to go shop at this particular shop,
or
you have to do this thing because this is what's expected of you. When you can make something at home that will work just perfectly well, or whatever, you know.
No. I think you're quite right. And I think the issue then that you're also raising is, where are the other ways of thinking about ourselves? Are we now so dominated by the market that and the idea that... we have to consume in order, therefore, to be somebody. So what about the other ideas of how we create ourselves as social beings? What's happened to those? And how can we promote other kinds of ways of being, which, of course, in themselves are oppositional discourses? They're opposing what an earlier caller said about big business, really, in the place of big business.
Thank you very much, ma'am.
All right, thank you. Let's go again to a caller here in Indiana and our toll-free line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
This is anecdotal, but at the beginning of the show, you were talking about, I guess it's the bootstrap theory. In some ways, you know, you just have to reinvent yourself in terms of learning new skills at the workplace. Well, anecdotally, where I'm from, town in Indiana that for years and years and years has been an industrial and / rural area. Well, industry is gone pretty much. Nobody came into the plant and said, hey, we need you all to reinvent yourself by learning some new skills.
Yeah.
What they do is they come in and said, we're going to have to drop wages, drop your insurance, stuff like that. And if you don't, bye-bye, because we're going to a place where it's cheaper.
Yeah.
Now, that don't have a damn thing to do with reinventing yourself. And it's not only that you speak it, it's spoken so much on TV and by the commentators and stuff. And I think it reverses, in a sense, makes it worse, because you look around and there's no way in hell when you're 58 years old you're going to get hired at
sure,
a job.
That's right.
Because the insurance, now they want the young because they have less accidents.
Yeah.
And when they're
they're cheaper.
So I just wondered if you'd make a few comments about that, and I'll hang up.
Absolutely. I think it's a very, very important point that you've raised, which is that, when you lose your job, especially for older workers, nobody's going to come along and say, reinvent yourselves. But at the same time, you know, people, older workers are often sent to, at least in Britain, I don't know how it works here in the States, but in Britain, people are sent to retraining schemes. You know, they'd be endlessly sent to courses that would be put on so that you can learn new skills, like keyboard skills and so forth. And one of the, in fact, I'd just like to mention some a case study in some research that I did, which was with older male workers. And one of the issues that came up was there was a guy who, very much along the lines that you're talking about, who'd been made redundant in his 50s, and he'd been sent on retraining courses, and he was invited to retrain as a cleaner, an office cleaner. And he kept going for job interviews. He never got the job, and he never got the job because he said he was perfectly willing to clean. He didn't mind what work he did, as long as it was good, honest work. But he was expected to go along and say that he wanted to clean. He had to go and sell himself as a cleaner, and he wasn't willing to do that. And he actually talked about the things that he held dear about his values as a worker. And they were all things like loyalty, phlegmatism. They were issues to do with being a male manual worker in an earlier historical period, whereas he couldn't, you know, you can't have loyalty in the present work context where you can be working for lots of different employers. So one of the problems for him was precisely not retraining in terms of reskilling, but the sets of values that we pick up that form our identity. So that, in a sense, suggests that the idea of the makeover itself is a very superficial thing, as though if we put on new clothes, we could, or even learn new skills, that would somehow easily remake us.
Well, not to put too fine a point on it, but it seems like what we're saying here, and what a number of the callers have said, is that you have to acknowledge the fact that there is reality, and then there is this story we're telling about ourselves about what's possible. And then in very many cases, the story doesn't score up with reality real well. I mean, maybe some people indeed can, you know, depending upon who you are and what your experiences are and what your abilities are and where you live and a lot of other things, how old you are.
Yeah.
Maybe it is possible to remake oneself. And yet I'm sure that there are a lot of people that it's just not.
Oh, absolutely. No, I think there are a lot of people that it's not. And that's why I also presented it as a fantasy, because I think whether you can apparently remake yourself or whether you can't, the issue is the issue, you're right, that the callers have been raising about reality, about the economic situation, about what it means to lose your job at particular ages, about big business and the importance of consumption to the economy. You know, those are the kinds of issues. But of course, those, as callers have quite clearly said, are not the issues that are being raised by the endless television programmes that present us with the fantasy that we could be the person we want and have the life we want if only we did make these changes.
Here in the United States, we like to believe that class doesn't exist.
I know.
even though it does. I mean, there certainly are class divisions in this country. It's interesting how I think if you went out and asked people about their class membership, that I think the vast majority of Americans would tell you that they were middle class.
Yes.
And that somehow encompasses in people's minds an enormous sweep of socioeconomic status. But anyway, be that as it may, we have this idea, I think, I have this idea at least, that in Britain there is a very firm understanding of class, that it's there, and that particularly people who are working class, there has been a fairly strong sense of identity, of belonging, and also of the sense that there is strength in numbers. I wonder what is happening to the idea of the working class, and whether people, how it is that people identify, does that group of individuals have any kind of political power anymore?
Well, I mean, I think it's a very interesting issue that you're raising, because I think things have changed a great deal, and it's mapping those changes that I've been particularly interested in. It certainly was the case that, yes, in some communities there would be a very strong identification around being working class. But if you ask people now, you're much less likely to get that class identification. It'd be much more like the kind of thing you're talking about here in the United States, where people would describe themselves as middle class. And I think that we can look at that historically in terms of a very particular period. That is the period in which Margaret Thatcher came to power in Britain. And one of the things she was absolutely determined to do was crush the power of the trade unions. And, of course, trade unions had been places in which especially a male working class identity through work was talked about. And there was a very famous strike in 1984-1985 in which coal miners went on strike. And Margaret Thatcher made it her duty, really, to defeat the miners, because the miners had defeated a previous Conservative government under Ted Heath. And she did. She broke the miners' strike. And it's always been said that, you know, that was the beginning of the end of the trade union movement, because, you know, she introduced so many sanctions against picketing, against going on strike, that actually the trade union movement was really crippled by it. And it's at that point that, well, she and one of your previous presidents, Ronald Reagan, came up with the idea that people called monetarism, that finance capital was really important and the market was all important. So, you know, there are certainly commentators and sociologists in Britain who would talk about this shift away from traditional class identities from that moment in the 1980s, in which manufacturing became less important and the market became more important, so that what you then had was the rise of aspirational identities and the idea that you could make yourselves over, and the rise of the market. That's certainly what people talk about in Britain, so that, and you've got markets opened up, global markets, so that Britain becomes much more like America.
Yeah. We have a couple of callers. We'll try to get them in. We have somebody on a cell phone, so let's get them. Line one. Hello.
Hi. I just wanted to make two comments. The first is in response to what you just said about Margaret Thatcher breaking the unions in at least the sense of the spirit of the unions. Ronald Reagan basically did the same thing with the air traffic controllers.
Right. I didn't know that. Okay.
And now, I'm an American, but I've lived in England for over a year. I've done sabbaticals there. And I think one thing we need to distinguish between the concept of class in America and almost everywhere else in the world, as far as I know, is that America has class based almost purely on economics. And so there is always a belief that people can move from one class to another. And what I found in England was that not only was it the work you did, but there was actually a social class structure.
Yes, that's
where,
true.
I remember once we were eating in the dining room, and my wife wanted to get some tea at Cambridge University, and so she went up to get it, and one of the servers, I'm not exactly sure what they were called at the college, said, "You're not allowed to do that. That's my position." I don't think you'd fight that in America.
No.
So I think there's that one thing America has is a much more fluid sense of class. Of course, that's leaving aside racial issues and things like that. So I just wanted to make that comment. Thank you.
No, that's okay. Very helpful. Thank you.
Right. Let's see. We'll go to southeastern Illinois. Another caller here on our line four. Hello.
I don't know. I think among waiters there's a saying, that's my table. But anyway, a couple of points, and I'm not, as far as makeovers go, I've seen some of those, both individuals and houses, and it seems to me that when they get through, they're not a great deal better than they were when they started out. I mean, the women have a new bit of makeup on. I mean, some makeup artists has put a little more makeup on them and maybe combed their hair or fixed their hair, but basically the main part of the makeup is that in the before picture, they're glum-looking, and in the after picture, they're smiling.
Well, that's true.
But and houses aren't. I mean, anyway, a couple of things that may not be quite to your point, and that is I think that in the United States, and maybe this isn't true in England too, that a lot of the classes anymore are intellectually divided, depending on what your intellectual interests and education are.
So what do you mean by that, intellectually divided?
Well, I mean that I would doubt, for example, that, now I may be wrong about this, but I would doubt that Mr. Inge has anybody within his close circle of friends who went no farther than the eighth grade, and probably no farther than...
I see what you're saying. Right, and, so you're saying communities aren't so mixed anymore.
Well, they don't. I mean, I think it's just well, in the first place, your circle of friends is often determined by your work.
Yep.
But before I know time's running short, so I'll make another point, and that is that the same uniformity in women's clothing that there is here. I mean, at one time, women would be caught dead, wouldn't be caught dead wearing the same dress as somebody else, but you see a store like the Gap stores, mm-hmm. I see them on television, mm-hmm. and they have row after rows of short, straight skirts, row after row of identical blouses, and, you know, I mean, they had a program on this week, I watched part of it on debutantes, and this one girl who evidently had plenty of money in her family was talking about she didn't have enough room for her clothes. And she had this one closet was her blue jeans closet, and she had that full of blue jeans. Now,
well, you know, some people would say that that's how young people actually gain membership of particular groups nowadays, that, you know, you've got to wear the right jeans, the right label, the right trainers, the right kinds of clothes, and that allows you to feel that you're part of something in a way that at another moment you would have gained group membership in a different kind of way.
Yeah. Well,
I'm not saying that's a good thing. I'm just saying that's what people say.
Well, it just seems that they don't want to mean that women don't. How much could one of those blue jeans differ from another one of the blue jeans?
But the point is that you could recognize it as coming from Gap or, you know, as you said, or whatever label was a good label for it to come from.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
All right. We're coming to the point where we have maybe about 5 minutes left, and I would like to switch to something completely different, and because I'm interested in having you talk just for a little bit about girls and video games.
Okay.
Because this is something that you've also done some research on, and that, as I said way back at the beginning, tomorrow in the afternoon, you're going to be giving a talk about this.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm interested in video games. Precisely. Well, I mean, it does relate to the kind of things we've been talking about, you know, how, in fact, children are also consumers these days and are a very big market in that, you know, video games are marketed to children who are sitting at home playing these games and no longer going outside to play in the streets or the fields. So that in itself is an interesting shift in relation to childhood. But what I'm going to be talking about tomorrow really is the way in which I think that in some ways the video game story or narrative builds upon the idea of the Hollywood Western. So, you know, in the Hollywood Western, the hero goes out and, you know, people shoot at him and he gets gunned down and he has a really hard time and he comes up again and he goes down and he comes up again and eventually he triumphs. Well, you know, if you look at the narrative of many video games, they're just like that. They're a kind of action heroic narrative. And so one of the things I've been thinking about is whether that narrative is a narrative of contemporary masculinity. Is it a place in which, not like the hero of the Western, but, you know, you can learn through technology what it means to learn to be a man in the present. And I'm also interested then in what that means for how girls and boys learn to play games and what it means to play them. Because if they are kind of masculine stories, masculine narratives, then of course that's a real problem for girls playing them. And people often say that girls are less good at games, they're less interested in games, and therefore that presents us with an important issue around girls and women's access to new technologies. So. Yeah.
I guess I am certainly not I'm sort of the wrong generation here and not an expert on the subject, but I gather that there have been some attempts by some people to make quote unquote girls video games.
They have,
I'm not sure that they have been particularly successful.
No, they haven't been particularly successful, and I think that that's because the people that are proposing those are looking in the wrong place for the problem. That is, they're thinking that if you can produce a video game format with what's seen as a kind of feminine content, then girls will do it. But actually, what I've looked at is the way that girls and boys talk about video games and also play them. And I think that there's this issue about how they try to, as it were, do a kind of performance of masculinity when they're playing the games while preserving doing femininity is much more the issue than than the actual content of the games. Girls are quite happy to kill the opponent just as the boys are, but it's a real problem to them if other girls are seen to think that they're too much like the boys.
Huh. So they're perfectly willing to play.
Oh, yes.
But
in my experience, in my research, yes.
Do they play differently?
I think, well, yes and no. I think they do, they play in the same kind of way as the boys, but at the same time, they often, in my research, a lot of the girls hide their competitiveness. So where boys are quite happy to be much more open about it and indeed flaunt their competitiveness, for girls it's more of a problem because they feel if they look too competitive, then the other girls won't be friends with them. So although they sort of do play in a way like the boys, at the same time, they're trying to hide it. So it's much, much more, their aggressiveness particularly is much more hidden, I think.
For those girls who are very serious about playing and want to play, sort of want to play with the boys, do the boys just treat them like another boy or do they somehow look at them differently?
Oh, no, I think they do look at them differently. And in some, they particularly don't like it. When the girls can beat them, I'm afraid they'll want to assume that they're better than the girls, and if the girl that a boy is playing with is better, then in fact one of the things that's noticeable is that the boys will turn to all kinds of underhand ways of stopping the game so that the girl can't win.
Cads. Well, I want to thank you very much for giving us some of your time. And for people who are now here in and around Champaign-Urbana, our guest, Valerie Orkerdine, will be speaking on this very topic that we've been just talking about. That is some of her research on video games as they pertain to gender issues in a talk tomorrow at 1 in the afternoon in the Levis Faculty Center on the U of I campus on the third floor. And it is open to the public. Anybody who is interested in is attending should feel welcome. And this is sponsored by the College of Communications, the Institute of Communications Research, and the Department of Speech Communications at U of I. Our guest, Valerie Walkerdine, is professor of psychology in the School of Social Sciences at Cardiff University in Wales in the UK. Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure.
The broadcast today made possible with support from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, with foods from around the world. Currently, they're featuring foods from Italy, including Italian cheeses like Reggiano Parmesan, also oils, vinegar, Italian chocolates, cookies, and coffee with taste samplings available. World Harvest Foods, 6th and University in Champaign, encourages you to join them in supporting public radio. And again, tomorrow morning on the show, Dave Desser will be here in the first hour. He's professor of cinema studies at U of I. We'll talk about the movies. In hour two, we'll be joined by Jean Redpath, well known for singing traditional Scottish music. She'll be giving a performance this weekend with the Chorale to benefit their Young Artist Scholarship Fund. And also joining us here in the studio will be the director of the Chorale, Julie Beiler. That's tomorrow. We're here weekday mornings, 10 to noon, 10 different topics every